The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
House prices reflected a bubble and too little time thinking about the consequences, if a bubble did exist, of its bursting spectacularly. More attention to the worst-case scenario might have left us better prepared to respond to what actually happened. That wins the understatement of the century award, given that they pumped up the economy and set the stage for a crash that was much greater than it would have been. Tim Geithner, who was then head of the New York Federal Reserve, as part of the Fed system, and later become Treasury Secretary under Obama, was a little bit more blunt when he talked about how he said this. We failed to anticipate the savage depth of the Great Recession on the debilitating feedback loop between problems in the financial system and problems in the broader economy. A mere drop in housing prices could not have triggered a mass mortgage defaults or depression-level losses in the banking system, but as unemployment increased and jobless homeowners missed payments, actual and expected mortgage losses increased as well, triggering margin calls. In other words, people had borrowed money to pay to buy stocks, had to pay it back all of a sudden, and sell-offs of mortgage-related assets, making the economy, unemployment, and the housing market worse. We weren't prepared for this kind of doom loop. We were too late to see how subprime losses could be the spark that ignited this dry tinder. In the end, we still ended up with a raging inferno. So, you know, that's, you know, it's kind of basically these books are How I Saved the World books. And they're actually full of some useful information. There's some obscure program that the Federal Reserve did to guarantee the monies that banks could lend to one another by being an intermediary that I didn't know about at the time, so I'm reading about this obsessively. And there's a funny little passage where Bernanke talks about when they assembled the nine biggest heads of the banks and says, all right, we've got this they call it the CPP, the Capital Purchase Program. And basically, the Brits had already started nationalizing banks, injecting capital. And they said, you got to take the money, but we'll make sure we won't have voting stock. You'll still be in charge. We're just going to bail you out. We're going to temporarily nationalize you and prop you up. And of course, they all say, well, we can't take the money. But of course, they all did. They were all strong-armed into it because the only way to stop an even greater unraveling that existed. And it's worth remembering that, because they want us to forget it, that the initial downward spiral of the U.S. economy in the fall of 2008, early 2009, was deeper than after the crash of 1929, the stock market crash. It was actually deeper. And, you know, in a sense, they did step in and did what they needed to do to stop the financial system from completely unraveling. And we were really on the brink of that. We were at the brink of a complete meltdown of the financial system that would have literally thrown tens of millions of people out of work immediately. And it could have even been worse than the Great Depression in terms of its impact. That was averted. They stabilized the system, and I'll go through in some detail, you know, kind of go through the history of that, how that was done. But it has not really restored growth, anything like what a quote-unquote normal recovery in the post-war era has been. And I'll go through the reasons for that, to take the most important figure. The U.S. economy has struggled to achieve an average growth rate of 2% a year since the end of the crisis in June, you know, formal end of the recession in the middle of 2009. Historically, the U.S. economy, when you average in recessions and slumps and so forth, historically the average is 3.5%. That doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're talking about a $15 trillion economy, it's enormous. It's tens of millions of jobs. The U.S. economy has just now barely gotten ahead in the last couple of years of where it was back in 2007. In terms of, even though unemployment is low, the gap between the potential and actual production of the U.S. economy continues to grow. And as a result, if you pay attention to what serious economists are saying, you're going to see the kind of same confession of ignorance and confusion that Bernanke and Geithner admitted to further on. Go into YouTube and Google the words economy and stagnation, or an economist or something like that, and you'll find some mainstream economists somewhere throwing up, whether they're liberals, Keynesians, or conservative monetarists, basically throwing up their hands and saying, you know what we thought doesn't work. Larry Summers, who famously called up the another federal official about regulation of derivatives, these complex securities, back in the 90s, and said, "I have 13 bankers in my office. You know, we're all opposed to this." You know, he was very much an architect of neoliberalism, as Treasury Assistant Treasury Secretary, and then Treasury Secretary under Clinton, has basically said, "You know what? Everything I taught in graduate school is wrong. Everything I learned is wrong. We have to go back to the drawing boards." I mean, he's got a long article in Foreign Affairs, a bourgeois imperialist publication, leading publication, laying that out. You've got Robert Gordon, a famous economist from Northwestern University, wrote a book called The Rise and Fall of American Growth, where he basically argues that that's the new normal. And you can find, you can just tune in to things like the European Central Bank press conference. Everybody knows they have their own YouTube channel, right? Yeah, all right. The ECB has its own YouTube channel. And you can watch the press conference. It's in English. And Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, is so worried about what he's going to say. When somebody asks him to repeat something, he actually gets back and reads his prepared statement about what, you know, it was. He talks about how optimistic he is that the European economy could grow 1.6% this year, and maybe 1.7% next year, maybe avoid deflation. So we have a creeping panic coming around the mainstream economics because the world economy is slowing down. We've already seen sections of the world, third world, newly industrializing countries, now known as emerging markets, the way capital thinks of them, are in deep crisis, indeed as a result of the falling oil prices. So Venezuela, as people probably know, is seeing its economy seize up, and basically hunger has returned as the collapse of oil prices has wrecked the model that Chavez had tried to build up in the last number of years. Some other oil exporting companies, commodity exporting companies, countries have massive crisis, like the Brazilian economy contracted at its steepest rate based on a big dive in its currency as the Chinese market slowed down. And really what we're looking at is a world economy that has not yet recovered fully from the crisis of began officially in the U.S. in December 2007 and ended in June 2009. Yes, there's been growth. Yes, there's been a recovery, but it's a recovery within a down in a very downward slope from our weak position. It's a growth characterized by weakness and stagnation in the historic core of the system in North America and in Western Europe, and an unsustainable boom and now an emerging slump in the developing world. And basically what I'm going to argue here, and this is something that's going to be laid out in detail in an ISR article that Joel Geyer and I are working on, is getting ready for publication, is that we're looking at the fourth great crisis of capitalism in the last 150 years. The first one was in the 1870s, the Panic of 1873. Which was a long depression. It's a period in which farm prices were depressed. It's the era that saw the populist movement, the rise of intense class struggle in from the 1870s to 1890s. The rise of a mass socialist party in the U.S. That was overcome with capital monopolizing industries, the birth of the modern corporation and imperialism, carving up the world into different spheres of influence. There was, of course, the crisis of the 1930s, which was a kind of a resumption of that unsuccessful bid to redivide the world through the first imperialist war, World War One. That was overcome by a boom stimulated by the Second World War, of course. And then you had based on the destruction of capital and the conditions for massive new investment and a new phase of the system, a great boom from the late 40s into the late 60s, and return of a stagnant economy in the 70s, based on a long-term decline in the rate of profit as a reindustrialized Japan, Western Europe, and so on began to compete with the U.S. on a world scale, pushing down the rate of profits as investment flowed more and more to capital. And then you had a restructuring that occurred through what we now call as neoliberalism, a restructuring of industry, deregulation, privatization, using new technology to radically reshape industries. So we have U.S. today produces more steel than ever, but with a third of the workers it used to. You could make the same case about auto and so forth. In some cases, whole industry, you know, exiting the domestic economy, like shipbuilding and so forth, as part of this restructuring, and with that a globalization. And the crack up of the Eastern Bloc under the pressure of globalization, not being able to compete with the West as it was taking advantage of a more dynamic and international division of labor, basically cracking up, the breakup of Eastern Europe and USSR, and the opening up to market capitalism from the old closed state capitalism model, opening up a market capitalism, bringing into the world labor market about a billion new workers. And this changed the composition of what Marx called the organic composition of capital. And what he means by that is organic in the sense that it grows over a period of time. It's the investment that capitalists under pressure of competition have to make in factories, offices, means of production in order to compete with the rival capitalists. You have to constantly, as Marx put it, revolutionize the means of production. You have to constantly invest in new industries and new technology. You can't stand back or you'll be defeated. But the problem is that ultimately profit can only be extracted by living labor. Capital profits by paying us only a fraction of what we produce based on our labor power. We're paid enough to reproduce ourselves, our children, and so forth, and then the rest goes to profit. Ultimately, that the pressure on profits rises as more and more capital is invested. The system was able to break through that fairly dramatically in the course of the 1990s and into the 2000s with these changes, a new sense of globalization, new technology, new sets of workers coming in, world gross domestic product grows about 50% in the 1990s. It's the era of the rise of the Chinese economy in that sense. And it's also, but this presents a classic problem. This is a problem that led the relationship between the nation state and the world economy. Well, we'll get to Brexit, you know, down the road on this theme. The nation state, of course, is how capitals in a given area has protection. The armed bodies of men and now women, now so progressive, armed bodies of men, women, and transgender people in the United States has this core state with its own traditions, nationalism, borders, and so forth, however that's been developed, whether it's in the old, you know, older so-called historic nations or post-colonial countries and so forth. These centers of accumulation, they have to be guaranteed by nation states. If you think about the old World War I and World War II era, you had companies, whole countries or imperial blocks are organized like a company, a virtual company, you know, with its own metal factories, its own industrial base, its own, you know, sources of agriculture and so on. So the scramble was to redivide the world. So Hitler wants living space, we're going to conquer Eastern Europe. You know, there was a scramble for Africa earlier on. In a globalized economy, it's more complicated. Well, we're not colonizing anymore. The U.S. is an empire through markets. We have to dominate those markets. We need hierarchy of imperial states. So there's the armed struggle. There's there's NATO. There's all these military alliances. But we want trade to be open to us, but on our terms. So what are the tools for that? That's the era where we have the World Trade Organization come into fore. Its predecessor was the ITO, International Trade Organization, which was first floated in the late 1940s, was slapped down by the U.S. and said, "We don't want to regulate world trade because we're dominant. We're two-thirds of productive power in the rubble of World War II. We want it for us." They come back. They bring that back to try to organize these newly emerging centers of capital accumulation in China, Brazil, South Africa, what have you, and keep them within a hierarchy dominated by imperialism. That's part of the goal. And at the same time, they're regularizing that. They also want within that to have their own blocks. So you have expansion of the European Union in that period, with a reunified Germany leading the way, which the U.S. signs off on, as long as Neil Davidson pointed out, as long as people agree to expand NATO as well. So the U.S. is still militarily, politically, the guarantor of the order in Europe. And of course, George W. Bush tries to expand NAFTA to all the Americas, the free trade area of the Americas. That falls apart because by then Brazil's too assertive, and they're not able. The relations of forces have changed. Plus, they're trying to fight two wars at the same time, so it's not a good sell. In Latin America, it falls apart. But this aim to try to keep to try to order a world economy with a changing relationship between this nation state and world economy, and where the U.S. goes from being, you know, its share of world global production is going down from the high 20s to the mid 20s, low 20s, to around 20%. It fluctuates based on the relative value of the dollar. But that's how the U.S. is trying to stay in the saddle. And it's in this period that the U.S. believes, from the 80s into the 90s, the U.S. sees China as a critical way of defeating Japan, which has been the rising economic power. And you know, if you're a comrade of a certain age, you'll remember all the panic around Japan, and all the horrible Japan passion movies, and so forth going on. It seems laughable now after 20 years of Japanese stagnation, but that was the perspective. China was just what corporate America wanted, because the Chinese government was willing, unlike the other East Asian countries that had industrialized, like South Korea and Japan in earlier phase and elsewhere, was willing to give corporations a much freer hand. So, in other words, use China as an export platform. Look at your Apple, designed in California, products manufactured in, South Korea, Japan, whatever, assembled in China, and the profits hidden in Ireland, right? That's the model. And so China was a great opportunity for corporate America, but at the same time, of course, it begins to emerge as a competitor at the same time. But the reliance on China is not just as an export platform. Also, China was had put those dollars it was earning through its exports someplace, and it put it in U.S. Treasury bills, bought up government securities, and that way financed the ongoing U.S. budget deficit. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the two, both in terms of a production chain with command and control centers in the U.S. and partly Western Europe, running through China, also China accumulating dollars, buying treasury bills, and at the same time trying to find ways of strategically implanting itself in the world economy beyond heavy industry into higher tech things where it would sort of compete with the U.S. The model starts to come under strain in the late 90s with the East, what we now call the East Asian financial crisis. There's a sell-off of different currencies, exit in Thailand and Malaysia and a number of other countries that saw their currencies plunge relative to the dollar, and it looked like in the Chinese yuan to a certain extent as well. And the U.S. economy at that time was going full tilt, its greatest full employment economy, essentially, unemployment less than 5% in the late 90s. The Federal Reserve stimulated an economy that was already in boom so that the U.S. consumers would continue to be a market of last resort for those export-oriented countries. So it gave it another big boost into the system and put off a recession until 2001, which finally happened. And what did happen was relatively mild. And one of the reasons it was mild was because, again, the Federal Reserve did what it could to stimulate credit and to prop up domestic consumption and compensate for what had been a long-term stagnation and decline in real wages. And that the impact of that was ameliorated to a certain extent by the growth of women in the workforce, so that family income could hold up, even though more people in a given family unit had to work in order to achieve that. By 2002, when the economy starts growing again, from 2002 to 2007, it's much more reliant on credit, much less reliant on new investment, new factories. In fact, it's the first expansion in U.S. history since the Second World War, where the economy expanded, the factory job loss continued. Now, some of that was due to technology. It wasn't all just due to outsourcing to China and so forth. And it's hard to pin down exactly what, but there definitely was a relative lack of investment in means of production and new factories and so forth. But at the same time, consumption was propped up by credit, housing being the critical part of that. And that began to fall apart as the economy began to slow down in 2007. And so the subprime market, the low end, where people with the highest risk, highest interest loans began to report late payments. And the whole edifice of the credit structure starts to wobble and begins to come down. And there's no time to go through the details in it, but essentially you had, with this great expansion of credit under first Greenspan and then Bernanke, his successor, you had a demand for investment for reliable rates of return that there was a shortage of things to buy. So certain things have to meet investment quality for certain investors, for pension funds and so forth. So how do you do that? Well, you guarantee them that you make it look like they're going to be credible and sourceful and so forth. How do you do that? You bundle a bunch of mortgages together, and that way they're generally packaged all in one in ranks and tiers if you buy these high quality ones you want. Anybody see the movie The Big Short here, or read the book? I mean, I think it's a pretty good job of explaining how that worked in a popular way. And we can go into that later if we want, but that's the old crisis. We need to get onto the new one. And so the very complicated financial instruments that took place that were sold at the time began to unravel as people had to basically pull in as they had to sell off assets, and so you had a chain reaction. And at one point, Bernanke goes through how they had to open up lines of credit internationally between the dollar markets in Europe and Asia could have access to U.S. Treasury. So the U.S. ended up bailing out the world as well as the U.S. economy, basically guaranteeing credit, guaranteeing all assets. And that was a guidance proposal. And funnily enough, it started in Ireland, because the small Irish economy, within this big tax haven, was the first to step up and say, we're going to guarantee all our banks. That forced the hand of Gordon Brown, then the Treasury Secretary, the Chancellor of the Exchequer of Britain, who then forced the hands of the U.S. to basically nationalize the banks that were wobbling and going out of business. So that brings us to the period of the bailout and why it actually... And the reasons why we have to, why we're still in trouble. Because you had a series of stimulus. You had the TARP program, Temporary Asset Relief Program, which was used to bail the bank, $787 billion, about $800 billion. Then there was the Obama stimulus program. Which was around a similar amount, which helped boost GDP, but it was really based on propping up the financial system and keeping things afloat as much as it can. It was not the second coming of the New Deal and big employment programs and so on that other people had hoped for and anticipated. It was essentially a kind of a corporate Keynesianism that provided a certain economic floor and then pushed out. And they tried the ideas of Milton Friedman, who was a famous free market economist, whose critique of the handling of the slump of the 30s was that they made money too tight, you should just give it out to people. And he once made a point, you should just drop it from helicopters, get money into people's hands, they'll spend it, it'll stimulate demand. And they did that in the form of a payroll tax cut. It was worth 2% for people, put in their pocket. But essentially what the Fed did was to move in and cut interest rates to practically nothing, to 0.25%. They bought up all the treasury bills that all the banks had held, which was basically a huge amount of money into the banks. And then they went on to buy all kinds of mortgage-backed securities that the banks had on their books that nobody else would buy. Again, shifting huge amounts of money into the banks. And consequently, the Fed balance sheet, in other words, how much it has on its books, went from around $1 trillion to over $4 trillion. And there's a quote from Trotsky in this new the To the Masses newly published about the debates of the Communist International. He said, we throw around words like billions and billions and never say what they mean in relation to the economy. So taking Trotsky's point, the U.S. economy at that time was like $13 trillion, $14 trillion. So $4 trillion sitting on the federal balance sheet is there. And we don't know what's in it. We don't know what it is. It's a confidential transaction. It could be property. It could be houses. It could be, a lot of it's commercial real estate, all owned by the Federal Reserve. And this is a key reason why the U.S. financial system was able to come back. But the U.S., at the same time, while doing that, the Europeans went along part of the way, but they started to worry about the implications for budget stability and governments not being able to pay back their bills. And the European Central Bank, which was a creation when the Eurozone was created, which 19 countries, which was created in 1999, it was very much dominated by the German central bank's policies to their benefit in a number of ways we could go into. And the ECB first of all, started raising interest rates, tightening and pushing austerity, worried that the weaker economies in Southern Europe that had big government debts wouldn't be able to pay them back. So they started raising interest rates, squeezing, forcing austerity on the various countries, Greece notably, but also Italy, Portugal, and so on, squeezing them hard and forcing them to be able to pay up until it. And the impact was a second recession in 2011, and after staggering along with a year or two of mostly negative growth around the Eurozone, they reversed course, and Mario Draghi, head of the ECB, I mentioned earlier, said he's going to do whatever it takes. So basically, follow the example of the Federal Reserve, and they had what they call, again, quantitative easing, which is central banker speak for printing money, which is achieved by buying up government bonds, buying up corporate bonds, and in the case of the Japan Central Bank, most recently actually buying up stocks. The Japanese Central Bank is now the top 10 shareholders in the biggest companies in Japan, kind of a creeping central bank socialism. So you have a situation with uncountable trillions of dollars have been injected into the system, both in the U.S. and in Europe, and yet growth remains stagnant, and yet it remains weak. Why is this? And the problem goes back to the problem I discussed earlier about the organic composition of capital, which I was trying not to prove my Marxist bona fides, but to talk about what's this issue today. This ratio of living labor to fixed capital, heavy industry, is a relationship which creates, as it builds up over time, organic competition puts a pressure on the rate of profit to fall. The system, it dogged the system in the 70s. It broke through it with the neoliberal boom, with restructuring and this new influx of labor. Now, given the incredible growth of China in such a compressed period of time, the greatest industrial revolution in human history, $30 trillion in credit, growing 10% a year for 10 years, massive transformation, more concrete poured in China in 3 years than the entire history of the world, everywhere else. I mean, these are mind-blowing statistics that you get. That's a lot of organic composition of capital, right? That's a huge shift, and especially with the Chinese workforce as big as their population is, it's actually the growth in the workforce is slow because of the one-child policy. You know, China's, in terms of capital and people and potential, it's getting tight. And so you have, again, this constant pressure towards overcapacity. It dogged the system. We saw it first start to appear as an issue in the late 90s with East Asian crisis. The impact was ameliorated by the U.S. ramping up the big spending and the stimulus of the late 90s. It appears again 10 years later with the crash of 2007-08, exacerbated, with demand collapses because of the financial crisis in the U.S. The U.S. no longer able to be the credit fuel importer of last resort, so massive overproduction in China. Now it's back, and it's coming back, in the sense that Chinese growth began to slow from 10, 11, 12, 13% a year in some years, down to something like, by official statistics, something like 6 or 7%. Some people will say it's 3 or 4%, and it's hard to say, but the key thing is the trend. You know, it's half of what it was before, which means that if you made money selling oil to China or exporting grain or money, you're in trouble. That's what's happened in Brazil. And it's created all kinds of political crises. We talk about tonight in the perspectives meeting, from South Africa to Brazil, you know, political ruling parties and crisis. It's produced Trump, Brexit, all kinds of political implications to that, which we don't have time to talk about here. But that's the... I've already talked as long as I said I was going to, so there's more to say. So I'll try to bring this to a close. So we have time to discuss it. We can always come back. So we have a situation at the starting from about early to mid 2015 up through the end of the year, when the data on the slowing world economy, the Chinese economy in particular, start to come in. You know, commodity prices start to crash. You know, radically, price of oil. Drop 60-70%, copper, all the key historic indicators of industrial production. World trade, which never really recovered much from the crash of 2008, also starts to drop down sharply. all kinds of alarm bells start to go off. First place that shows up that everybody starts to notice is the Chinese stock market panic of August of last year. And that seems relatively contained. Some bank stocks start to go wacky in the West as well, because nobody quite knows how much debt exposure Western banks have to China. The latest figure I saw was about $1 trillion, which is, you know, the great scheme of the world economy is not overwhelmingly huge, but the point is that, you know, it can have a domino effect and nobody really knows. And then again, at the beginning of the year in January, where this time there was actually the data on the Chinese economic slowdown was even greater, and so the bank panic in the West was even greater, as it became clear that while the U.S. banks had gone a long way towards restructuring themselves, thanks to all kinds of free money from Treasury and the Fed, the European banks hadn't done that because of contradictions to do with the European Central Bank. And so the European banks are still pretty sick and still have a lot of bad assets, and they're weaker than their U.S. counterparts. So the specter of a financial panic in China meant that there was a lot of panic about the implications of in Europe. And I haven't even talked about Greece yet. Greece was more it was partly about the money, getting the money back out of Greece, but it was mainly about making sure that nobody else goes in that direction, Italian banks and so forth. Because the Italian banks, it turns out, have greater percentage of they're worse than what Greece was at the start of the financial crisis. 18% of Italian loans are non-performing. 18%, that's a lot. And Deutsche Bank, which was the flagship bank of Germany, itself has been the scene of repeated attempts, seen its stock go down radically. People think, well, you know, we don't know what's inside its books, but it can't be good because it's still invested in Greece and has all kinds of other issues. So the Chinese wobble at the beginning of the year was felt very, very strongly. If you just think back what it was like in January. So what do we have? We have another round of stimulus. We have a huge stimulus that was, you know, boosted by the U.S. and by China in particular, ramping up the industrial economy again, and at the end of 2008 into 2009, the Chinese government had been attempting to kind of rebalance its economy, shift more towards a longer-term more consumer-led economy, and get off the addiction to huge industry and exports to the West. They decided that, well, we would like to do that someday, but we can't afford to do that now because the economy is slowing down. We're worried about these constant wave of rolling strikes around the country. There's tensions within the Communist Party. The trial of a maverick official, Bo Xilai, brought to light a few months back. So we're going to step on the accelerator again, and we're going to reindustrialize. And so you have, and something I think is very telling, the reopening of a bankrupt steel mill complex, which had actually been completely shuttered, a relatively new plant in southern China, which had been completely shuttered a couple of months ago, was reopened. That plant alone has enough capacity to equal all of Britain's steelmaking capacity. China's excess steel capacity is greater than what the U.S. can produce, right? And so what they're doing, they're adding more stimulus. They're adding more to it. So think of the whipping the horse one last go around the track, but this is the contradiction of China being the motor of the world economy. The U.S. is not in the same position to do that. And again, what are we looking at here? We're going back to this contradiction between the changing relationship between nation state and world economy. This is something that the Bolshevik economist Bukharin wrote about, Imperialism and World Economy, has an intro by Lenin. It was developed in parallel with Lenin writing his writings on imperialism, and Bukharin said, look, that's the basis of this world war. We have social production under capitalism or private ownership, and now the fusion of private capital with the state, what he called state capitalist trust, means there's going to be conflict of imperial power. Now, then it was a very rigid set-piece battle. There's a central powers, there's Britain and France, there's the U.S. Now it's more complicated because there's centers of capitalist accumulation, historic, you know, metropolitan centers, but now there's new centers of capital accumulation, which are totally intertwined with those metropolitan centers. So where are the levers? How's that play out? Very difficult. Very difficult for them to try to figure out a strategy to get out of this. So the strategy so far has been this Frankenstein combination of some Keynesian stimulus and some monetarist policies of easy money. Neither one has worked. In the U.S., there's been some, and it's not just in the Hillary Clinton campaign, some optimism about the possibilities of U.S. economic growth, because this is the first time in 100 years that the U.S. hasn't been at the epicenter of the crisis. It's in China, somewhere else. So the idea is, okay, lower oil prices is going to hurt our industrial boom that we've had in oil and gas, but we'll survive that. There'll be bankruptcies and so on, be reorganized. The banks can we'll have some losses from that, but it's all absorbed. Long term, we're going to be, we'll survive the energy price war with Saudi Arabia. Unemployment continues to go down. Demand is coming back based on the growth of new jobs, like 6 million jobs in the last couple of years. That's real. They're crappy jobs. They don't have any benefits and so on, but it's real. And so the hope is that, if we can navigate this financial crisis and so forth with China, we'll be able to turn the corner and grow. The problem with that is you've got so many different communications channels of the crisis that any number of them could bring, and some of them are economic and some of them are political. The economic ones are the fact that companies like Caterpillar and Boeing have made huge amounts of money exporting to China, for example, or building in China, or taking advantage of that boom, or Caterpillar selling industrial earth-moving equipment in the Australian mines, which mine the raw materials to send to China. So a lot of those companies have taken a hit. You have the interdependent banking system, and we don't really know how interdependent they are. We didn't know until they all started falling apart in 2008, 2009. There's no they're inherently interlinked. A bank is not a thing. It's as reified as it's an arrangement, an agreed upon consensus that there's some amount of surplus value concentrated related to this and such assets that in a series of crises when the bills have to get paid is the only time you actually find out what's really there. So we don't really know how that's going to play out. It could be a financial crisis that is communicated to the U.S. economy. We have that, of course. We have a political transmission spell of crisis, which is Brexit. And really, what Brexit represents is a growing feeling among sections of the European capital that this arrangement is not working for them. You have in the EU a setup by which Germany was able to effectively devalue its currency with the creation of the euro. The Deutschmark was a very strong currency based on German economic industrial dominance in the region. By merging it within a common currency, it was relatively cheaper on the world market. It was made much more competitive overnight, created an internal market for German exports of industrial goods. Germany has a trade surplus bigger in dollar terms than China. It's never happened in the history of the world that an advanced country would have that kind of trade surplus. So it's a good deal for the German capital. It's not so good if you're Italian, medium and small, where companies are more medium, small size, and exported to Germany. If they're becoming more and more productive because they've held down wages and they're more productive, you can't compete with them. If they're shifting their supply lines to Asia, that cuts you out. Is this such a great deal? Maybe not. French ruling class has similar themes. Now, they're not about to, it's a minority view, and Le Pen in France is trying to appeal to sections of capital and fuse that with a populist anti-immigrant proposition, and the same thing has happened at various parties in Italy and so forth, and the same thing played out in Britain as well. The main establishment players in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party were against Brexit, but there was enough of a wedge being opened because of the slow growth a desire to try to renegotiate this deal. Like, okay, the changing relationship of nation state and capital, eventually we're losing our autonomy as capital. We need to come up with something different. Now, it was a half-baked plan. They didn't have a plan B, and suddenly they got a big mess on their hands. But it's it's symptomatic of broader issues, and it really could trigger, if not an immediate collapse of the EU, although that can't be excluded in a deep crisis, a steady unraveling and more conflict. So create space for France and Italy to push back. I don't think it's a coincidence that the day, like a couple days, a week, less than a week after Brexit, the Italian central bank, the Italian government, went to the European Central Bank, a European Commission, and said, that rule that says that you we can't have direct state aid to our banks now without violating the rules. Well, we need an exception to that. The European Commission said, okay, how much? So it's $160 billion they have a reserve, and because the Italian banking system's in deep trouble and could crack in a serious way. So there's any different ways this thing could play out. The political crises around Brexit and whatever could leads to questions about investment. Well, where do I put my money? What's actually going to go on here? That could then open the way for Hillary Clinton or other, Obama while he's still in office, to stimulate the economy yet further to try to avoid this kind of panic. So that's what's playing out in the world economy right now. Am I going to say that there's going to be a recession? That's easy. If you're a Marxist, you understand that even honest capitalist economists that acknowledge that there's always typically 7, 8, 9 year cycle, capitalist cycle of expansion, so forth, and then decline. The question is, what shape is it going to look? What shape is it going to take? How deep could it be? And the problem is that you have the unresolved problems of the last crisis, of a crisis of overproduction. Too many goods, not just too many goods, but too much means of production to be able to realize a profit centered in China, but of course, but going globally. At the same time, you have enormous amounts of debt with amounts of debt in relation to the world economy that we've never seen. Like the Chinese debt is something like some people say it's 250% of GDP, some people say it's 280% of GDP, in the US it's 300, in Greece it's 320, but it's never happened. We've never seen that in a developing country before, with an less developed financial system, without something like the US, the treasury bill market that the US has. So there are many, many fault lines that could happen, and the potential for another financial panic and a crack up is very real. And I think, so the point for us, I think, shouldn't be to get into the prediction game, but to engage with the people around us in labor and say, look, this economic picture means that this is about as good as it gets to what we have right now, and the capital is going to keep coming after us. They're going to keep squeezing it. They're going to try and solve this with some restructuring. We don't know what form that's going to take, but we know it's not going to be good for our side. We know it's going to involve ratcheting up the rate of exploitation. It's going to involve squeezing people harder. It's going to involve pushing the cost of the debt onto the working class. It's going to involve more cuts to social spending. There may be some other, we don't know what form it's going to take, but it's here. And so therefore we can't have the expectation that we're going to go back to some, it's been a long time ago now, but the old days of partnership bargaining and where capital and labor had these stable relationships, the kind of thing that Hillary Clinton is spinning out now. That's continued to be eviscerated under Obama, and in a given crisis, capital is going to even push even harder for that. I mean, you have opportunities where workers have some leverage, like the Verizon strike. It's not saying it's going to be uniform and all at once. There are leverage and pressure points. We need to take advantage of those now while the economy is good, but understanding that this is the ride that we're in for, and we have to buckle down for it. So again, I haven't thrown a lot of numbers in there and haven't given that, it's been more political economy and outlines than anything else. If people want to go into some of those details, okay. We'll be right back.